The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
Evening. It's this time of the week again. It's Thursday night. I'm David Zeidel. This is the AutJet Business Show. And with us tonight is Professor Adrian Saville. He's the Professor of Economics, Finance, and Strategy at Gibbs. And if you care anything about economics, markets, and where Africa and the world is heading, and understanding strategy, this is someone you'll want to hear from. Adrian is a professor, as I said, of economics, finance, and strategy, and he spent more than 25 years moving between the worlds of academia, investment, and entrepreneurship. He's worked across global markets from Brazil to Singapore, built and sold investment businesses, and he's helped raise hundreds of millions of dollars in capital along the way. He's also behind some of the continent's most widely used investment research, including RMB's Where to Invest in Africa report. And he currently chairs a venture capital investment committee. What really sets Adrian apart is his ability to take complex ideas and make them very practical, helping leaders and organizations figure out where to go, how to go there, and really why it matters. So, Professor Adrian Saville, it's great to have you with us. And as always, just before I get to the actual interview, I give a little bit of a business story. And I've given over the last year, I've given different business stories from different businesses. And tonight I'm going to start a series of 18. And it comes from my book. I wrote a book many years ago called Life on the Run, 18 Steps to Success. And it was the lessons I learned through running. I ran a couple of Comrades marathons. And it's the lessons that I learned through running that apply to business and life in general. And the very first lesson I'm going to share with you is kind of the thing that sparked me writing the book. I was running a race near Pretoria called Umdidam, which means around the dam. First of all, I didn't realize how big that dam was. And now I know why it's called the dam. It was damn hard. And after it's slightly more, it was either 50 or 56K race. And when you get to the stage of about 40 kilometers, you've already run almost a marathon. There's this massive hill. And I was running up this hill. And when I say running, it became more and more like walking up the hill. And I was moving. And when you get really tired, you're looking down. And I kept looking down. And at some stage, I thought to myself, I can't do this anymore. And I was about to quit. And as I was about to quit, I looked up and I realized how close I was to the top. So I pushed a little bit further. And then it became easy as I went down on the other side. And my thought was, wow, how many times in life have I been through things where it got really hard? And just at that point, when it got so hard, I just gave up, not realizing how close I was to actually pushing through. And then once you push through, it becomes easy again. So the lesson from that is, whatever you're doing, if you're looking to give up, ask yourself, maybe it's getting hard just as you're about to break through. So that's my lesson for today's session, but we're going to hopefully get a whole lot of other lessons from Adrian Saville. So Adrian, welcome again.
David, thank you. I'm listening with delight to your running experience, because my commitment at the start of the year was to look after my head, my heart, my soul, my body by running. And so I've gotten into the very good habit of, you know, getting onto the road 4 or 5 times a week. But I'm not yet at the 50 kilometer territory.
Okay, fantastic. So you can look after, what did you say, your head, your heart, and your body. The one thing you're not going to look after are your knees. So I must warn you about that. But before we get to the interview with you and before we go further, we just need to take a quick ad break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm David Zeidel. You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. And we're about to start the interview with Adrian Saville, who is embarking on the madness of following in the footsteps of so many other mad people of running. So before we get to the interview, have you never been a runner before?
I'm built to go fast down mine shafts. Yes, I have been a runner. And if I were to sort of try and give myself an archetype, I was very good over 100 meters and in particular 110 meter hurdles. And I had sort of a, yeah, you know, that was a place where I really had great delight. But you know, now, you know, many years on, I'm not going to go faster over 100 meters or 110 meter hurdles. And you know, it just seemed to be to be able to go out a couple of times a week, an hour and a half at a time, was a fantastic way to clear my head, look after my soul, try and, you know, manage my body. And yeah, you know, so I've what I thought initially was going to be drip torture has turned into a bit of an addiction.
So welcome to the club. And I think just that story of you were built and you did more speed stuff and now you've changed is almost what businesses go through, that you need to adapt the business to the context in which you're in. And I'm sure we'll get to more of that as we go through the interview.
I mean, you know, I think, David, that's, you know, such a great sort of jump off point, you know, into the conversation about, you know, building businesses that are fit for specific circumstances. And you can have the exact same circumstance, but different businesses that will need very, very different requirements based on industrial positioning, the nature of competitiveness, the age of the business, you know, and perhaps entrepreneurial businesses are sprinters doing 110 meter hurdles, and your multinationals are marathons, ultra distance marathon runners.
And obviously the training and the behavior of those companies has to, by definition, be completely different. Before we get into that, just take us back to where you started off. Where did you go to school? How did you land up being a professor? Is that something that you, in your early days, that you thought you were going to be? Are you where you thought you were going to be? Or was that a strategic move? Or did it just happen organically?
There was no strategy involved at all. So to, you know, to get my education into the conversation, I was born in Durban. I went to a school called Westfall Boys High, which our headmaster described as a damn fine institution. And I'm proud to say, and I think, you know, many years on, in fact, this year is our 40-year school reunion, matric reunion. I've still got a fantastic, you know, network of guys who went through school with me in those foundational years. And the school itself has gone from strength to strength. So there's, and I'm proud to have that as part of my upbringing and the years that shaped me. I went to university at what was then the University of Natal. And my idea initially, heavily influenced by my parents, my father in particular, who's a chartered accountant, was that accounting would be a good idea. And it didn't take long for me to figure out that this was not a place that was going to set my heart on fire. And by, you know, you asked, was the strategic? By luck, I guess. You know, I learned that I had this absolute fascination with, many would describe sort of softer sciences, I'd like to call them behavioral, you know, or social sciences. including economics, sociology, law. And that's where I did my majors in economics and law. And I then did an honors, a master's, a doctorate in economics. Because I was becoming, inverted commas, a professional student, I needed to figure out ways to support myself, to contribute to my maintenance. And there was an opportunity to teach at the university, and then an opportunity to also do research. And it was that cocktail of, you know, serendipity that led to me learning that I get tremendous purpose from teaching. And so that's, you know, that's how that came about. Whilst I was finishing my doctorate, I had a crazy idea that it would also be a good idea whilst doing a doctorate to start an investment business. And so the investment business and the doctorate, they both coexist. 1994, I'm starting the doctorate. I start the investment firm. And 3 years later, I'd finished the doctorate. 30 years later, I'm still working in the investment industry.
How do you manage both things? Because both of those things, people struggle to do each thing on their own. How did you manage to balance both of those huge balls at the same time?
I think, David, it's, you know, it's helped by your own makeup. And I think it helps, you know, whether you call this functional or dysfunctional, it helps that I have got a very, very high work rate. I don't think that you can, you know, feed these hungry animals doing pedestrian hours. So I think that, you know, I would put that down as a necessary condition. But more than that, I can't tell you a day in memory when I've woken up and thought, I actually don't like what I do, or I don't get reward or satisfaction. There are days when I think, you know, I'm not going to enjoy today. There's going to be tough stuff going on, or hard decisions to take, or, you know, I'm going to have my feet put to the fire. But having this combination of a high work pace and then, you know, just this fascination with this field of work. And then, you know, I'd put a third component that they don't compete, they actually coexist. That rather than, you know, the one jealously taking from the other, they actually feed each other in a very, very rich way.
If you can take us back to when you started that. So first of all, you say it's still existing. How many years later did you say?
Well, the investment business actually started as a syndicate, as an investment syndicate, where 10 friends got together first Tuesday of December 1994, and we put some money in the kitty. And that syndicate, 3 years later, became a licensed investment firm, licensed by what was then called the FSB Financial Services Board. It took the shape of, I would describe as sort of a well-regarded boutique investment firm, Cannon Asset Managers. And that firm grew over the next 20 years and eventually was acquired by a listed company. I then took time to sort of recalibrate, reset, making a couple of mistakes in that recalibration, you know, thinking that this might be a sensible direction of travel, but it was the wrong road, or the street was too narrow, and, you know, had to do about turns. And end of 2024, a few things came together that really gave birth to my circumstance now, where I look after a company called Boundless World, which does the things that you described in the intro, where to go, how to go, and why to go. That's the strategic advisory firm. And part of that, we have investments in investment management companies, one in Guernsey, one in South Africa. So, you know, the investment business is still very much core to what I get up to each day. The strategy work really feeds, you know, again, these different parts of my work, they feed each other so richly that if you're going to be allocating capital, you know, whether it's you're allocating capital or help someone else think about how they allocate capital, this makes a few things imperative. The first is understanding the context in which the decision is being taken, how that context matters to the performance of the business, the returns you can anticipate, how you allocate capital, take portfolio decisions, and then the relevance of business models. So, you know, again, I try and, you know, underline the point that all of these things feed each other so richly. And then it would be, you know, remiss not to, you know, also make a very clear reference to the business school, where you've got people constantly challenging you, you know, on, but, you know, what you're arguing here doesn't work in my business, or this hasn't been my experience. You know, here's different evidence than what you're claiming. And so, you know, to be in front of a business class where you're not so much a teacher as a conductor, I guess. The Socratic method is one of conversation and engagement, rather than I'm going to come and try and dump a whole bunch of models on you, which you need to download and send back to me. Undergraduate teaching has a very important place. But in a business school setting, the minds are less agreeable to downloading and data dumping.
And they say the way you learn the most is actually to teach. And that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. I think you, in that sentence, you've nailed it.
So I want to take you back a little bit to that, because you kind of, and I've heard this from business people often, where they say, well, I went and I started doing this and then we grew the business. And I want to try to get down to that granular state. So you were 10 people, you took some money, you start investing, which a lot of people have done. I did that in my day with a few friends. It didn't turn into an investment company. How do you go from investing just as a few friends to actually creating a business about it? And from that, do you remember the process?
I remember the process well. And thankfully, I remember the process well, because, you know, I'm in the process of doing that again right now, helping other companies that are in the process of doing that. And I think that there's a couple of things that are central to this. The first thing that's key in the process is knowing what it is that you have. What's your point of distinction? Do you have something that's different and unique? And, you know, I would call that, broadly speaking, a business model, that you've got something that gives you an edge, a point of distinction, something that isn't either copy and paste or copyable and pastable. You also have to have a second component of this, and that is a willingness to take on the challenge of institutionalizing, you know, let's call it corporatizing, that if you aren't open to scaling, and scaling doesn't necessarily mean that you're operating in, you know, with hundreds of thousands of customers and, you know, many industries with multiple products in different countries. Scale means that you're going from a lifestyle business, or a business where it's just you taking the decisions. If you're taken out of the equation, the business falls over. You know, that's what I'd call a lifestyle business. And that's, you know, that can be tremendously rewarding, but you're going to have a hard time ever selling that business or taking that business across geographic borders or industrial borders. You necessarily need to be able to industrialize the company and or the enterprise. And that industrialization is about not seizing opportunity. It's actually first about mitigating risk. How do I mitigate the key person risk? How do I remove operational risk, balance sheet risk, income statement risk, key customer risk, key product risk? That is a central part of moving from an idea to something that is scalable. And then I think the third, which it took me a tremendous amount of time to learn, and I wish, if there was such a thing as a time machine, I would go back to Adrian 1994 and say to Adrian 1994, here is the key ingredient you need. And it's the people you partner with. That the people you partner with, and partner don't just mean the people who put money into the business. I mean people who provide you with services, people who help you with your governance, your board of directors. People who you partner with are your customers. They are your partners in business. And if I think that this idea of partnership, and or in my experience, this idea of partnership is misunderstood and underappreciated, and just how powerful it is. So if you, you know, if you're going to do this, I think pay disproportionate attention to the people who are around you, the things that are helping you scale, the products that you have, what your customers are saying to you as your partners. And difficult customers can be fantastic partners, amongst other things.
So those are, I think the points that you've made are crucial, and I want to reemphasize them again. So you're saying you've got to have a point of distinction. How are you different from others? Then you said you've got to find a way of mitigating risk. And then, obviously, as you emphasize, it's the people you work with, the people you partner with, and, mm-hmm. and those people include the customers who you're helping. But I just want to take you back, because I think you've jumped a little bit ahead from where I wanted to go, where you were looking at, okay. You're looking about maybe what you're doing today, and these points are crucial. When you started the investment, was the investment, when you put people together, and maybe my understanding is incorrect, was it you were investing on the stock market, or do you put money together, yep, to start a business? And then how does that grow into a business where much bigger than that?
Got you. Okay. So, you know, when I talk about the 10 people who came together, those weren't sort of hands on deck in a business. It was, you know, 10 friends. I don't even have to use inverted commas. It was 10 friends who got together on a Tuesday evening and said, we're putting money in a kitty, and pointed to Adrian and said, you know something about investing. And let's say, you know, in the land of the blind, you know, the one-eyed. So, you know, I was appointed. I was given the responsibility for, you know, for helping make some investment, or for making some investment decisions. And, you know, out of that, it really was a learning by doing experience. We didn't have a business plan. You know, there wasn't anyone else that we were looking to that, okay, well, we're going to copy them or emulate them. It was, I'll go back to your earlier comment, you know, was it by design, strategy, or was it by mistake? I would put this squarely at the foot of, you know, luck, chance, that I had 10 mates who said, this is a sensible idea, we'll come along.
Can I stop you there for a second? Because you said it's luck, sure, and chance. And I know that you do a podcast with Professor Nick Bernadelle, which has, yes, those two words in it. What is that podcast called?
It's called Fate, Luck, and Choice.
Fate, luck, and choice. Okay.
You know, fate is the hand that you've been dealt. You can't really change the hand that you were dealt with. You were born in a certain context, a certain parents. Those are your start conditions or your predetermined conditions. Luck is the way the dice roll and things happen through luck. We can call this, you know, luck, chance, serendipity, coincidence. You can give it a whole range of different names and flavors. And then choice is the decisions you take with the hand that you've been dealt and the way the dice falls. When you turn the cards, what do they show? Is it a king and, you know, is it diamonds? Mm. So, you know, and if it is a king of diamonds, there's not much that you can do about it. How do you play that now? That's the choice stuff. And that's, to my mind, you know, the essence of strategy is how you separate that. You could find a person who has the exact same circumstances, the exact same preconditions, and lands up in very different places. You know, perhaps we go a little bit, you know, off east here in the conversation, but there's fantastic evidence on studies of twins. twin companies, and quite literally biological twins. They have the exact same birth condition, but they land up in entirely different places, whether they are people or businesses.
It reminds me of an amazing story where there were two brothers, and one was a priest and one was in prison. And they asked the guy in prison, how did you land up in prison? And he said, well, my father was a drug dealer. My mother was a prostitute. What could have I become? And they went to the priest and asked him the same question. And he said, well, my dad was a drug dealer. My mom was a prostitute. What else could I become? And it's exactly what you're saying, that people take different circumstances and make something out of it. I want to continue with this and find out, how did you go from those 10, and I'm going to pull you back into that conversation, to then what happened, if you can take us through a process of starting the business, and then how did you change that into a business, and what are you doing today? And I know you've done massive research with a massive amount of companies where you created what you call the DNA of a company, and I'd like to get into that, but we'll do that after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're in a fascinating discussion with Professor Adrian Saville, who started an investment with 10 friends, took the money, put it together, and then through that, a business grew. And he started that at the same time that he was doing his PhD, and both have graduated very nicely. And one of the key points that he made is you've got to understand the context of where you're at. You've got to know, how are you different from others in a business? You've got to know how you're going to mitigate the risks as much as possible. And you've got to understand and be comfortable with the people, both in the business and with your customers. So, Adrian, I'm going to take you back a little bit of, you started investing, you were put in charge of it, and you said 3 years later you actually registered the business. So what did you do? You invested in some other businesses, and did you register a business because more and more people wanted to be involved in the syndicate? Or what was the process? You talk about people. Those people involved, did they just go along with your decision? Was it a discussion? Did you learn from it? Just take us through that process.
Sure. So, you know, we behaved initially as a syndicate. And, you know, we had, you know, a memorandum, you know, that set out, you know, the terms of engagement and, you know, who could belong to the syndicate.
So you'd made it a formal process right from the beginning.
Yes. Now you're really jogging my memory, but perhaps, you know, let's say by month three, you know, we realized that this wasn't just, you know, that money was involved. And the moment money is involved, you know, this has to be taken seriously. What you describe, you know, is exactly, you know, what then materialized. It's, you know, it's a good description, you know, that sort of people learn about it. You know, they came along and they said, oh, you know, they've heard that Stuart is involved, that Quinton is involved, Corin is involved. Could they also join? It came clear, you know, through that we had something that was on offer that wasn't available elsewhere. Now, again, you know, that it would be grand for me to say, you know, at the outset, I had this fantastic plan. I knew what I could design, and, you know, away we go. Here's what I think we had built by mistake, is we had really taken investing, which can be quite intimidating, financial terms, economics, capital markets, they, you know, these can be very intimidating animals. And I was writing a note to the investors, and this is the day of fax machines. And the note was then faxed, you know, at the end of each quarter, but with, you know, real sort of layperson terms that helped them understand what we were doing. Was I taking the investment decisions? Ultimately, yes, I was responsible for you know, pulling the trigger. But we had everyone was involved in coming to meetings. If you didn't come to meetings, you couldn't be in the syndicate. And so everyone was involved coming to meetings. There was buy-in. There was debate about what we were buying. And 3 years later, now I've finished my academic studies. I finished my doctorate, the PhD, and I have this moment of crisis. What on earth am I going to do with the rest of my life? And a very good friend at the time, still a good friend, a chap, Warwick Lucas, says to me, well, why don't you register, license the business? Like, it's right in front of you. That's what you're going to do. And I mean, the crisis had gotten higher and higher because I'd been interviewing in industry. And what I learned was that the appetite to hire PhDs into investment firms in the 1990s, my background experience composition, the appetite was zero. I was not going to get a job. I'm making fun of it now. From a psychological perspective, an emotional perspective, it was unbelievably stressful. I just couldn't see, you know, what the path looked like. And this really good friend, Warwick, sat with me over a coffee one afternoon and said, but why don't you apply for a license? And the next step was, you know, to get the help of Deloitte, apply to the FSB. And it was, I would say it was that Deloitte moment that really, you know, underlined the gravity of what we were going to do next, that we had to have a policies and procedures manual, that I had to appoint a board of directors, you know, that I had to have this thing called share capital and regulatory capital, that I had to now, you know, submit reporting to the regulators, including the South African Reserve Bank and the other financial authorities. Michael Porter, the Harvard Business School professor, says that very often your regulatory environment can be a source of competitive advantage. And I think that, you know, having the setting for South African firms, that we have such a fantastic regulatory setting, has actually helped not, you know, the business I grew, I'm talking about South African financial services generally, be a globally competitive force. So now we've iterated into a formal business with board meetings, board packs, reporting to clients. We're putting in place the technology, all of the operational architecture, and we start to become a business with headcount.
And then you obviously started taking a percentage of the fees or the turnover so that it could fund you for personally from that.
And no, so, can I say no? No. Can I say no, that I didn't take a salary for 3 years?
Didn't you?
No salary for 3 years. The way that I was able to do that was because I had by then I'd been appointed a professor at my University of Natal then. I had a very, you know, supporting and accommodating environment where I was able to look after a full-time professorship whilst also growing a business. And I think, you know, there's no sort of big secret in that academia is one of the places where you probably have the closest opportunity to being entrepreneurial with the security of full-time employment. And so, you know, whereas many academics would use that running room to go and do other things, I used that running room to build the business.
So I want to go back to the points that you made, that your point of distinction that you talk about within the clients, your point of distinction, how you different was that you did it with friends, and your mitigating of the risk is that you could actually run the business at no cost to them, but you were being funded elsewhere. So you, maybe without even realizing it, you were using your own formula even within that.
If you look backwards, it's so clear, you know, what the things were that helped bring together the performance of the business. these were the things that mattered. My frustration is that strategy has almost perfected the art of hindsight bias or look back bias. Is they find things that work, and then they go and ask people who have had their hands on these things that work, what did you do that worked? I mean, it's circular thinking, and you're not going to get any powerful insight on how to do the next thing by using that circular thinking. Those are the things that mattered, but I didn't know at the outset that those were the things that were going to matter. And maybe I even imagined them, you know, if maybe I was doing something else that was helpful. Yes, we had fantastic investment returns. You know, those certainly helped. You know, that made a case for the business that, you know, what I was calling high net worth individuals was anyone with about $500 and upwards. So, you know, there could be many things going on, but, you know, perhaps that's a great place to go to talk about the work that we've done on understanding the DNA of businesses.
Right. And I want to get to that, but we'll do that after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel. We're on 101.9 High FM, and I'm speaking to Professor Adrian Saville, and I've spent a lot of time going through the history of how he got to where he was and building up from starting an investment club. But I want to move and jump right ahead to the DNA of companies, because you've looked at a huge, and I think you mentioned the number of about 40,000 different companies. I might be incorrect on that number. And looking at the DNA, can you take us through what is the DNA of companies and what's the meaning behind it and the usefulness of knowing what that is?
David, so the study that I reference is a study of 20,000 businesses over 40 years. That's the data set. So you've got this massive mountain of data. It's worth, you know, perhaps just telling two very quick stories to explain why this study of businesses, of these 20,000 businesses, is so important. The first is, you know, my concern in a lot of the strategy that is business bookshelf strategy is that they are studies in luck and happenstance, and that when you look at the businesses, the business books that are amongst the most celebrated, Built to Last, Good to Great, In Search of Excellence, when the books are published, the businesses that they are describing, that they are concentrating on, are very successful businesses measured by all of the usual criteria: revenue, market capitalization, profitability, growth over the last 10, 20 years, et cetera. Once the book is published, you go and look at the performance of the businesses subsequent to publication, and there is an overwhelming experience of business failure, a disproportionate experience of business failure. And so what's actually happened in these studies, and Michael Rayner has done fantastic research in the run-up to this, to my comment, is what's happening is you're studying businesses that are big, and then you're asking them, how did they become big? And they're describing all of the things that they've done, but there's no disentanglement of skill and luck. Let me give you a statistical equivalent. If we got 64 people into a room and asked them to flip a coin, heads and tails, there is one person who would do six in a row. And that's just statistical luck. And now, if we write a book about the person who's done six in a row and said, we've found this incredible capability to flip six in a row, and then we ask that same person to come back the next day and do it again, they wouldn't, because they were a statistical anomaly. That's the error that has led to, you know, I think it's a corruption of business storytelling. They're fantastic stories. They're impressive businesses, but they don't afford insight into businesses that have been able to A, do, and then B, do it again. And so what we do in our study of the 20,000 companies over 40 years is we control for your industrial circumstance, we control for your country circumstance, and we control for the distribution of luck using Monte Carlo simulation. I mean, that's a boring conversation for statistical nerds. Out of that, we're able to identify just 400 companies that are truly exceptional. And in those 400 companies, so 400 out of 20,000 is 2% of businesses. 2% of businesses are truly remarkable. And then we go and ask, with a deep study of all of their business histories and behaviors, what are the things that are common to those businesses? And that's what we refer to as our agility absorption framework.
So I know I'm dying to hear, and I'm sure the listeners are dying to know. So what are those things? Is it something that you can tell us, or is this like
absolutely
top secret?
Not top secret, not at all. And we're in the process of completing a white paper on this. So in fact, this will be published in the next couple of months. But the attributes belong under two broad umbrellas of agility and absorption, and they coexist. That in order to be agile, and agility is not going fast. Agility is having optionality. Agility is actually the ability to choose your speed or adjust your speed. But in order to go fast and slow, you need to have latitude to change direction, to do things differently. And that means, you know, if you misstep, it can't be a disaster. But also, if you take a punch, you need to be able to come off the ropes and throw a knockout punch. So absorption is the ability to take punches as much as it is the ability to throw punches. And agility is the ability to go fast as much as it is the ability to go slow. And that's the ambidexterity or ambiguity in strategy, is you actually need to be all of these things at once. Now, and even those are fairly, not fairly, those are very abstract notions. You know, what do you actually do practically? What do agile absorbers look like? They are learning organizations. They are curious. And learning organizations shouldn't be confused with businesses that do something new and then do it once. So if I said to you, you know, we've just discovered this new technology and we're launching it and we've taken 80% market share, that doesn't make you a learning organization. That makes you an organization that did something once really well. What makes you a learning organization is an organization that is curious about its own positioning. What did we get right? What did we get wrong? How can we do this better? What are our customers telling us? And we call these bottom-up organizations or listening organizations. That one of your greatest sources of industrial intelligence and market knowledge is from your customer. Piyush Gupta at the Development Bank of Singapore gives two fantastic hands-on tools that help you fashion this inside of your business. And the Development Bank of Singapore makes a customer journey and an employee journey KPIs, that each year you have to do a customer journey and you have to do an employee journey. You have to go and learn what one of your colleagues is doing in the business. And the customer journey is you have to experience what the customer experiences firsthand. And through that, you can get into, you know, business model refinement. They've got lazy balance sheets to the horror of accountants. They innovate at every level of the firm. They don't take big bets. They tend to take lots of small bets. And then when they get evidence that the small bet works, then they double down on the small bet. M&A, yes, but they usually pay cash and they buy businesses that they know. They are happy to shrink, not just grow. And that runs in the face of almost all business strategy. I'm yet to meet an executive team that says, you know, their strategy over the next 5 years is to shrink. And, you know, here is the however. What if growth, or growth at all cost, is actually the cause of your death? You know, growth by definition is not good. It has to be good growth. You know, that's going to feed you. They reduce layers between the C-suite and operations, so that improves communication. They encourage risk-taking in federal structures. So you take the risk, but you report to me, and they are data-obsessed organizations. They know what's going on with granularity. And I'd make a last note. I mean, there's more, but you know, I've tried to capture here the heart of the ideas. The last attribute that I think is worth putting on the table, we've touched on it a couple of times, is that company and community are inextricably intertwined. And that's not about vegetable gardens and painting schools or dishing out books. It's that what we mean by company and community is that your business makes the communities it operates in better places. You know, think of building financial products that are fit for purpose. Your community is your users of financial products, and they understand the fees, their expectations are realistic, the solution that's being sold to them is appropriate for their circumstance. That's the company and community being intertwined.
So what we in South Africa call that transparency that everyone talks about.
Transparency and fitness for purpose.
If you take all of this, and I'm a small business and I'm just starting out, and I'm trying to get to do something similar to what you're talking about, what would I do as a small business to fit into this listen to your customer, take small bets, and then double down only afterwards, not grow too fast, to really to look at the agility and the absorption? So as a small, small business, maybe myself or two or three people, what do you suggest one should focus on to make use of what you're talking about here?
That's a lovely question. And, you know, perhaps it helps land this point that if you're going to scale a business, whether you're going from, you know, 3 people to 30 people, or 30 people to 300, or 300 to 30,000, there are components here that are common to the business journey. And so let's imagine you to be this hypothetical 3-person business. You've got customers. You can go and speak to your customers. You could try and onboard yourself into your own business and experience this. I mean, and funnily enough, you know, in one of the businesses that we're doing work with, I had exactly this experience a couple of days back as I was being onboarded in the business. There are so many things that you could learn through this. If you're open to that learning, then by next week, because you're a small business. In fact, Piyush Gupta gives his employees 72 hours to come up with solutions. And in a 3-person business, 72 hours is ample time to figure out a new or different way to do things. So be open to that feedback. Be open to trying things. The earlier point I made about partnership is that partnership, the people that sit alongside you, adjacent to you, are very, very powerful parts of helping grow your business. If you're a 3-person business, you want to make absolutely sure that you've got the best 3 possible. Not like-minded, different-minded, because that's where you're going to get creativity from. That's where you're going to get challenges from. You want to make sure that you've got a serious board, you know, that get the best possible people onto your board. Listen to your customers, listen to them carefully. Find the best possible suppliers that help you punch above your weight.
So unfortunately, we're running out of time on this, but just to sum up a few of the things that I've personally taken from this is when you were looking at your investment initially, you had what I'd like to call your Deloitte moment. We all in businesses have that moment where it moves us to something else. And the key things you said is to understand that your success might not be just the skill, it might be luck, and understand where your luck is and where your skill is. And again, learn from things that you've done wrong, but be a listening and a learning organization. Keep always listening to what your customer is doing, and maybe not even listening to them. Take it one step further and what you called the onboarding process of be your own customer and see what your customer is going through so that you can see maybe what's not working for the customer and what you can learn from that. And then it's overarching all of that. It's be a company that you and the community on one, in that if your customer deals with you, you're making the community a better place. And these are just some of the things that I've taken from what you've said. And I think it's been a hugely rich interview. And I really want to thank you for sharing that with us and look forward to the white paper that you spoke about. And maybe we can get
some feedback. Thank you, David. Thanks for the invitation and the opportunity.
And maybe we'll get another discussion with you once that white paper is out. So thank you very much. This has been the Orchard Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we've had this fascinating talk with Professor Adrian Saville. Just remember, based on the discussion, you can learn to earn. Good evening.